The Fourth District Appellate Court of the State of Illinois is now convened. The Honorable Eugene D. Doherty presiding.
Good morning. Please be seated.
Good morning.
Court is calling 4-25-884 Christ v. Jones consolidated. Would counsel for the appellant please state your appearance?
William Sirignani for Kelly Christ and behalf of her son, Jared Seckerman, late Jared Seckerman.
Jason Boucher on behalf of appellants Pete Unders, Anthony and Tony Unders on behalf of Seth Unders.
Do you have a time split?
Your Honor, I was going to begin the argument and presumably we have some time left over to pass counsel.
Okay. And for the appellee?
Good morning, Your Honor. Gregory Bird for appellees Christopher Jones, Karen Jones, and Jason Haas.
Good morning, Your Honor. Bob Varney, along with Mary Allen, our office, on behalf of defendant appellees Allen Haas and Haas Farms, Inc.
And do you have a time split?
We do, Your Honor. I was planning on going 10 minutes and split that. Cool.
Okay. Appellant may proceed.
May it please the court. The negligence in this case is that corn was grown too tall and too close to the intersection of intersecting roadways such that it was impairing the visibility of the drivers on those roadways, and also that it violated the Woodford County Ordinance dealing specifically with the issue of visibility. Now, all parties agree that in this case, the issue of whether plaintiff can establish legal proximate cause is dependent on a foreseeability analysis. The difference between the parties is
that... Can we clarify, when you say it impaired visibility, you agree, I think, that at the point where a vehicle is to stop, I think that was County Road 2400, at the point where the vehicle is supposed to stop, visibility was not impaired, that the driver could have seen the approaching ambulance?
That is true.
And would it be true, just simple physics,
sure,
that the approaching ambulance could have also seen?
Sure, it goes both ways. Visibility is a two-way street.
Okay.
You bet. The difference, as I was going to say, the difference between the parties on this issue of foreseeability is the subject of that foreseeability. In this case, the defendants and the trial judge believed that the subject of the foreseeability was the exact manner of this accident, a car that didn't stop fully at a stop sign and entered the intersection. But that's not the law in Illinois. The law in Illinois is the general harm that can be foreseen from a particular act of negligence. And in this case, the general harm is auto accidents. Not being able to see each other either increases the risk, or to flip that around, the ability to see each other decreases the risk of auto accidents. That's the foreseeability analysis in this case. And in this case, there is overwhelming evidence that auto accidents are foreseeable from impaired visibility from corn growing too close or too high to the road. For example, common sense would tell you that. Anybody who's a driver age would know that if I cannot see somebody, or the longer I have an opportunity to see somebody, the more likely I am to avoid an accident, or the inverse. If I can't see somebody, it's hard to avoid an accident, and that's particularly true in this case. The ambulance drivers talked about not seeing the car until it was literally in front of it in the middle of the intersection. Secondly, the ordinance itself establishes the foreseeability concept. Ordinances like this are in existence precisely because they recognize, particularly in rural roads that aren't always well lit, they recognize the need to increase the visibility for cars approaching an intersection such that they can reduce the possibility of accidents.
And so, counsel, if I can interrupt you there, and I believe you were alluding to it, but then the ordinance is designed to assist her on County Road 2400 East as she's approaching, because you said as they're approaching the intersection, correct? Because the other 116 did not have to yield to that county road, correct?
So I respectfully disagree. I think the ordinance is designed to protect both drivers. It's obvious that the point of the visibility part is to create visibility for the driver where the ambulance was going, as well as her as she was approaching the intersection. It wasn't just for her. Now, the third basis in this case to show that the foreseeability of the general harm was well known and in existence is the defendants themselves. We have an admission by the farmers that on their other farms, they intentionally did not grow the corn close to the road, and they did not grow it high precisely because they were worried about interfering with the visibility of drivers. But even if we were to look at the exact manner of this accident and ask ourselves whether or not that might implicate the superseding intervening cause, a type of cause that's so extreme or so outside the norm that it interrupts the normal causation change, we still have, and we still come back to, the question of foreseeability. And in this case, people running a stop sign, people drinking running a stop sign, not stopping fully, is particularly well known in this community, in this area. Every single person in this case testified that they have observed repeatedly over and over, despite the fact that stop signs are there, despite the fact that the law says you're supposed to stop, people consistently not stopping at stop signs. It's precisely that type of behavior that this visibility statute helps minimize the risk of. Again, Your Honor, to back to your point, not necessarily for the driver of the car in which my client was in, but for other drivers who see people running a stop sign earlier than they normally would, and they're able to avoid an accident. So that foreseeability analysis also points to a basis for a plaintiff to establish a legal proximate cause in this case.
I want to ask you a hypothetical here. I want to understand the importance of the stop sign to the defendant's right to summary judgment. If it's not a stop sign, let's say, and that's a yield sign instead, any impact on the analysis?
No, sir. I don't think the signals at the intersection, whether they be yield signs, stop signs, or stop lights, really are relevant to this query.
What about no sign?
Or no sign.
It's a non-controlled intersection. Foreseeability, is it still the same? I mean, if you want to put it in a qualitative way, you know, is it more foreseeable that there will be a collision occurring if there is a visual barrier, that being the growing crops?
So I would say the answer to the question is yes. Clearly, if there are crops, you have decreased visibility, whether it's a regulated intersection, a partially regulated with a yield sign, or an unregulated intersection. The reality is that each driver on the intersection will be able to see each other sooner than they normally would have, irrespective of whether they're supposed to stop or they're supposed to yield. The point of this is actually to litigate or to help prevent accidents for people who don't always behave the way they're supposed to, or just in general, to allow both parties to see each other earlier to avoid these types of accidents.
What on the record supports the inference that had the corn been cut back farther and the ambulance driver had seen the other vehicle, that the collision would have been avoided?
So I'm going to answer that question, Your Honor. I want to say to you, I would like to defer to counsel for UNRU because he's better prepared on those materials. That's how we divided our time. Okay. But I'm going to answer your question. There is expert testimony in this case that I have presented, or our side has presented, from an accident reconstructionist and also a person who talks about the biomechanics of injury. And the testimony of the ambulance driver, who said that if he had seen her earlier, he would have taken evasive maneuvers, he would have lifted his foot from the gas pedal, he would have tried different things.
How is that competent testimony? Because it's not telling us what he did. It is his supposition of, oh, if this had happened, I would have done that. How is that even competent testimony?
Well, there's absolutely no way that I would ever be able to prove what anybody would actually do in that accident scenario without actually asking a driver what his custom and practice was as an ambulance driver, which was asked of him.
Isn't it a conclusion for the finder of fact rather than for a witness?
I think that the witness could testify based upon his driving experience, his training, all of his experience on the road, his experience in seeing other cars come to an intersection, how he behaved, what he did, why he does it, and let the jury decide whether they believe him or not. I think that's a jury question. It's certainly not a question as a matter of law.
Well, the expert's talking about the ambulance driver seeing the vehicle sooner and slowing. But what about the other vehicle seeing the ambulance and slowing?
I think that's exactly
the same thing happening, same point of impact between the two vehicles.
So, Your Honor, the evidence in this case is that the car driver actually began to slow her car. And the inference from that behavior indicates that if she had had a clearer view and the ambulance driver simultaneously had a clearer view, that the accident could have been avoided, or, as my experts pointed out, the collision impact would be different and that the occupants of the car would never be as seriously injured or killed as they were in this case.
Well, to follow up to Justice Doherty's question, I mean, was this ever a question presented to the court that this is just pure speculation as to what either driver would have done and ultimately how the impact would have been altered and the injuries been lessened?
Your Honor, it's not speculation if it's based on evidence.
Well, the question is whether or not the court was ever presented with that question.
So the court was presented with affidavits supplying the testimony of the ambulance driver, supplying the testimony of the accident reconstructionist, supplying the testimony of the biomechanical engineer's testimony, indicating that had they had increased visibility, more time to see, and if the ambulance driver did what he said he would do, plus there's always a possibility that he would say he'd do other things, if he said what he was going to do, the impact point would be different. And if the impact point is different, then the injuries are different. And that's not speculation. That's based upon evidence. It's based upon the scientific evidence. It's based upon the measurements. It's based upon whatever measurements biomechanical engineers use in order to establish their opinions. As far as what the driver would do, the only way that I'd ever be able to prove that is to ask him, based on his experience, not don't guess, don't make anything up, but based upon his experience, how would he handle this?
I think you may be using your...
I see that my time is up. Thank you, Your Honors.
Morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. Adding to my co-counsel's arguments here, there are also procedural issues with respect to genuine issues of material fact. Because,
counsel, if I may follow up on what was stated there, the argument was that the evidence showed there'd be a different point of impact. Was there any evidence to suggest that the collision would not have occurred?
I don't recall if the experts opined on that. I do know, though, that the experts did opine that if the one variable, Mr. Delgado, the driver of the ambulance, had a more time to see the approaching vehicle, Morgan Ryder's vehicle, he would have been able to do exactly what he testified to, hit his brakes sooner, slow down, which that would have changed the impact zone of the crash, which would have allowed Seth Unruh and Jared Seglin to survive the crash.
He's on a protected road. Certainly it's nicer to see a car coming up in a calm way, coming gradually to a stop on the intersecting road. But I think we've probably all driven where somebody comes zooming up to the stop sign and makes a quick stop. It just seems like a lot of speculation and a lot of hindsight to say he would have known, oh, I better bring my vehicle to a stop on this protected road because this person is coming up fast on the stop sign.
Again, Your Honor, the only thing we can do is to ask the question of what his prior driving experience alludes to or does, and he testified that he would have, or he has taken defensive actions, and he would have done it there. However, I don't think it is speculative to say that had he had greater sight lines, he would have been able to anticipate more easily, rather than what he did testify to, which was he couldn't see Morgan Ryder's vehicle until it was too late, she was already in the intersection, and the collision occurred.
So, except we know he would have seen the vehicle because she would have been able to see him before the intersection, right? Where she stopped? Where she should have stopped.
There is no question, you are correct, that Had she stopped at the stop sign, he would have been able to see her, she would have been able to see him. However, that completely, 100%, gets rid of the protections that are afforded by the Woodford County Visibility Ordinance. The Visibility Ordinance doesn't contemplate that the analysis starts and stops at the stop sign. The Woodford County Visibility Ordinance goes beyond what the rules of the road grant you for protections.
Right, but if it's all about visibility, once the record establishes that they both had visibility, what role is the corn playing anymore?
Because the Woodford County Visibility Ordinance would have required visibility much further back. It wouldn't have been just what could you see at the stop sign, it's what could you see 50 feet prior to the stop sign. Because that's what the Woodford County Visibility Ordinance would have required. And that's why the only testimony that's in the record is from our experts about what they could or could not have seen at 50 feet back. And it, our experts testified or had in their affidavit that, yes, the corn operated as a visual obstruction of oncoming traffic. And then you have Joe Delgado's testimony that he could not see Morgan Ryder's vehicle until it was too late into the intersection.
We're asking a lot of questions that pertain to the expert's testimony. It's not the basis of the trial court's decision here, correct?
That is correct.
It's not the foreseeability. However, you understand there's concern in regards to that portion of the proximate cause aspect of the negligence action. Why don't you talk about the foreseeability here? Do you have a sense if this was an uncontrolled intersection, whether or not the foreseeability analysis would have been any different?
So the sense is that if it was uncontrolled and the Woodford County Visibility Ordinance is in play and the testimony...
Everything else being equal.
So everything else being equal...
We just take away the stop sign.
I don't believe it the analysis changes because the Woodford County Visibility Ordinance does not materially restrict the protections to the general public to whether it's a... controlled stop sign, or controlled intersection, uncontrolled intersection, or partially controlled intersection. And the analysis goes beyond that as to what other evidence is in play that could demonstrate whether or not this should be a jury question on foreseeability. And part of that is addressed in the First District's case in Beal, where they present that if there's any direct testimony of prior knowledge or should have knowledge, or any other types of knowledge of the specific negligent act in question, then that adds to the evidence of whether or not the specific conduct is foreseeable and should be reserved for a jury, not for the judge to determine at summary judgment, because proximate cause is a fact question. And here, just like in Beal, there is testimony that establishes that their defendants were generally aware of what rolling stops are, or California stops, or just failing stop signs. General knowledge. Specific knowledge of neighbors in their area that are problems and do in fact fail stop at stop signs, and the specific harm that would be caused by that by having substantial injury or death. They had either acquaintances, loved ones, or family members, or friends that suffered from those injuries, that either had serious injury or died. So they are generally aware and specifically aware of the consequences.
It's the specific awareness that I'm struggling with, because the idea that somehow foreseeability is a matter of experience and evidence as opposed to a general understanding, because it's a risk that isn't anticipated at that moment, at that time, in that intersection. You're building out a foreseeability case by saying, look, we know neighbors who roll through the stop sign. I'm not sure there's a driver who doesn't have an awareness that somebody can roll through a stop sign. So it seems weird to me that we're making this a matter of affidavits.
It would be a matter of testimony and evidence, and it's what establishes the genuine issues of material fact that would preclude summary judgment. It's not that it's the ultimate issue, it's that it's a part of the puzzle. And the part of the puzzle that precludes the judge from determining what proximate cause is or isn't versus a jury. And that is the distinguishing factor there. It's a part of the evidence, and it's evidence that leans more towards reasonable foreseeability than it does not. And that would be what the specific aspects of that are, the specific testimony from the defendants themselves.
So that would be evidence in the case?
Yes, Your Honor. It would be
evidence. The jury would hear about, oh, I've known neighbors to have rolled through stop signs?
It can be, yes. So,
let me follow up with that. Before the court, most of, and I just want to clarify, the evidence that you're suggesting was the affidavits or the testimony about being aware that others, the California stop was used frequently throughout.
Yes, the defendant's own testimony through their depositions.
I guess my question is, was there additional, I'll call it evidence as you're suggesting, or affidavits about people just running stop signs?
The officers that were also deposed were generally aware of the issues in the area, but I don't believe there was any specific testimony in the record for that specific intersection.
And if I recall correctly, you stated that she was slowing down as she approached the intersection, and it was still at 14 miles an hour, correct?
So the data that we have that's in the record comes from the black box of the computer. Measures 5 seconds up to the point of impact of the accident. It measures 5 seconds back, and then it intervals up to a half second prior to the accident.
Okay.
It measured that she was going 35 miles per hour at the first point of measurements to 14 miles per hour, a half second prior to the accident. So that actually dovetails into the circuit court's ruling on total inattentiveness, and why there's a genuine issue of material fact with respect to that finding as well. Because I believe that this case is not that Morgan Ryder was totally inattentive just because she failed to stop at the stop sign. She's not totally inattentive when there is contradictory evidence that she's slowing down prior to the intersection that can be surmised as total inattentiveness. When the case the circuit court relied upon, Jamie v. Zeiger, the facts in that case was that the defendant driver testified that the roadway was wide. He had an unobstructed view of the car that he ultimately hit. He admitted under oath that he was feeling the effects of 10 to 15 beers, and most importantly, admitted that he was not paying attention to the roadway, that he was looking to his right, talking to the plaintiff passenger upon impact. And the court further found there was no additional evidence of braking or any other skid marks that would allude to whether or not the driver was trying to take evasive action or any other independent action than just not paying attention to the roadway. That doesn't exist here.
You want to wrap up your
remarks? Yes. Sorry, Your Honors. So that contradictory evidence for both the genuine or for the total inattentiveness and for part of the foreseeability aspects is what precludes the lower court from ruling in favor of defendants and granting summary judgment. So, thank you, Your Honor.
The appellee.
Thank you. May it please the court. The circuit court properly granted summary judgment because the material facts are not disputed. Ms. Ryder was intoxicated. The stop sign governing her approach was visible and unobstructed by anything. She did not stop, and had she stopped, as Illinois law required, she would have had an unobstructed view of the ambulance, and the collision would not have occurred. Appellees assume for the purpose of summary judgment that the court may have violated the Woodford County Visibility Ordinance. But even on that assumption, plaintiffs still have to prove legal causation. They could not do so because Ryder's failure to stop and yield was an independent superseding act under many cases, Merlot-Thompson, Waters, Kirschbaum, Cork, and Boylan, for example. Plaintiffs' reply briefs do not identify a genuine factual dispute about those dispositive facts. Instead, they recast an unlawful failure to stop as a rolling stop. They rely on generalized testimony that some drivers sometimes roll through stop signs and offer speculative theories that earlier visibility may have changed the impact configuration in the injuries. None of that establishes that appellee's conduct legally caused this collision. And that's why we respectfully ask that this court affirm. The record in the party's brief established that Ryder was driving while legally intoxicated, failed to stop at a stop sign, and would have had a clear view of the ambulance had she stopped. The ambulance had no stop or yield requirement at that intersection.
Can I interrupt on that?
Sure, sure.
Jurisdictional question. The judge below seemed to be quite willing to give a 304A finding when the summary judgment was granted, and somehow the issue of bifurcation came in, which I don't understand why you would take the long way around when there's a Supreme Court rule that's designed to get this to the appellate court. What was the thinking on bifurcating?
I do not know, and I can't answer that question. I'm so sorry. At any rate, proximate causes is sometimes a jury issue, but it's a question of law where material facts are undisputed and only one legal conclusion reasonably follows, and that's the case here. As far as some of the points that counsel brought up, first of all, the ambulance driver's inability to see Ryder sooner does not alter who had the statutory burden to stop and yield. The ambulance driver was on a through highway. He had the right of way. He had no stop sign. Ryder was a driver approaching a stop sign, and the vehicle code placed a duty on her to stop, come to a complete stop, by the way, not 14 miles an hour, not a rolling stop. Not only to stop at the stop line, but if she is unable to see approaching traffic on the intersecting roadway, move forward and stop again. Obtain a view such that she could clearly see that it was safe to enter the intersection, and obviously yield before entering if it wasn't safe. She didn't do so. She didn't stop at all.
Mr. Berg, yes. I asked a question of plaintiff's counsel in regards to whether or not it makes a difference in the analysis, whether this is a controlled intersection or not a controlled intersection. Does the analysis change if there's no stop sign?
I think there are different restrictions on an uncontrolled intersection, and I think it's whatever vehicle is approaching first to the intersection is allowed to go first, and if they both approach at the same time, this is dusting off the memory banks from driver's ed, but if both vehicles meet the intersection at the same time, it's the one on the right that gets to go into the intersection first. And so I think it would change the analysis slightly, but only because it would be a different statute.
Well, I'm just going to take it to an extreme. Most country roads, rural areas, aren't controlled by stop signs.
True.
You have uncontrolled intersections. And if every intersection had row crops, corn, planted all the way up to the shoulder, far less visibility than what's shown in the photos, Dr. Thomas's photos, all the way up to the edge of the road, let's say, you're saying still rules of the road would say the drivers would have to slow down to the point where they know that they can proceed safely across, and there's no difference in this case?
Absolutely. It'd be the same if...
No approximate cause.
In that case, again, if you're asking about the ordinance, it's we agree. The general objective is to improve visibility at an intersection. We don't dispute that. But that proposition doesn't resolve legal causation in this instance. The circuit court assumed the violation. The remaining question is whether that violation legally caused this crash after an intoxicated driver ignored a visible stop sign and failed to yield. In the event that there's an intersection without a control, like a stop sign controlling either direction, if both vehicles just blew right through the intersection, both are violating the traffic laws, different traffic laws. So I don't know if that answers your question. It probably doesn't.
Go ahead.
Sure. Thank you. But as far as the awareness of other drivers or even some of the witnesses that were deposed, the general awareness that people sometimes commit traffic violations is not evidence that appellees should foresee an intoxicated driver failing to stop at an intersection. And entering into the path of a favored vehicle, which it did in this case. The generalized knowledge of traffic violations, if generalized knowledge of traffic violations eliminated that superseding cause, then that would violate what the holdings were in Waters and Boylan and Cork and the other cases. What matters is not whether someone can imagine that a driver might violate a stop sign. It's whether the law treats that violation as likely consequences that a landowner must guard against. If you look at Kirschbaum, the court said, it seems clear that defendants could not have reasonably anticipated that Blatt, this is the violator, an independent party would fail to obey a plainly visible traffic control device. The court said, no. The only behavior that defendants can reasonably be held to have foreseen is that Blatt would have obeyed his statutory obligation to stop at a stop sign. Same case here. And then Kirschbaum, they said, Blatt's negligence broke the causal connection and made defendants alleged negligence merely a condition and not the proximate cause of the injury. Same situation here. So, I don't know how much time I have. Thank you very much. Okay. The circuit court assumed the ordinance violation and still correctly granted summary judgment because plaintiffs cannot prove the required element of legal cause. Riders intoxicated failure to stop at a plainly visible stop sign and to yield after stopping was the independent, direct, superseding cause of this collision. She would have had a clear view had she obeyed the law. The cornfield was at most a condition. It was not the legal cause. The appellant's replies offer no competent evidence, admissible evidence, that different corn placement would have prevented the collision. Their theory rests instead on the speculation that the ambulance might have seen Ryder earlier and the crash might have unfolded differently. That's not enough to establish proximate cause under Illinois law. For those reasons, we respectfully ask that you affirm the lower court's decision. And I'll turn it over to my colleague. Thank you.
Hey, please, the court. Again, Bob Varney on behalf of defendant Alan Haas and Haas Farms, Inc. I'm going to try and jump right into some questions that were asked by the panel, starting, first of all, with bifurcation. I was present during the arguments before Judge Fellheimer in the circuit court below, and an issue arose with one of the plaintiffs, Blake Hurt. He was the only one to survive this accident, and a passenger in the car driven by Ms. Ryder, who didn't stop at the stop sign. Doesn't recall the accident, but he had a pending case against the Ryder estate. Both Unruh and Sugarman had settled their cases. So a motion for summary judgment was decided in favor of the defendants by the circuit court. That resolved all issues of the Sugarman and Unruh case, and it was decided at that time at the request of the parties that we get 304A language. The judge approved it as to those two issues. The other case right now, best of my knowledge, Blake Hurt still pens against Morgan Ryder. That's my first answer to the question. Secondly, as far as what would have happened if the ordinance had been followed in this case, what's amazing is plaintiff's experts do not say the accident would not have occurred. What they do claim is that the dynamics would have been different, the impact different, and perhaps the damage is not as great. This is not a damages case. This is about proximate cause. That's what's before the court as framed by the circuit court below in their ruling. So there's no evidence in this case that had the vision, the ordinance been complied with, would there have been enough vision to prohibit the accident? No. Additionally, it's in our brief, the brief by Alan Haas, Haas Farms, Inc., that the testimony of ambulance driver Delgado is speculative at best. It was a back and forth among the attorneys over objections calling for speculation as to whether the corn planted according to the ordinance would have assisted him in dealing with the accident. He said it might. So when you have the argument about the ambulance driver, you're really putting speculation on top of speculation. Those are not the facts before this case. To deal with the other question, that if this case changed, if in fact there was not a stop sign, the court below considered that and said, in the opinion, which is part of the record, I may decide differently if there wasn't a stop sign.
So there may have been a different decision on that. I think the Illinois rules would go by. I will just state that I grew up on Illinois Route 122 near Delavan, a farming area. The highway, state highway, has stop signs at every intersection with the county roads. In this case, Route 116 was the state highway, the dominant highway. Stop signs every intersection with a county road. The county road had a stop sign, required to stop. That's the key of this case. And Mr. one Barney, thing I think is lost in
the... Let me interrupt you just a moment. Sorry, I'm sorry. It was please. On the latter point that I do want to follow up with you on. That we're, you know, most certainly deciding this case, but we also are aware of how what we say in this case can be then used in future cases and how it could be interpreted, maybe expanded. So we can envision other scenarios, let's say in an urban setting, a FedEx truck that is making a delivery near an intersection that's controlled by a stop sign. So a very similar set of circumstances here where you have an individual coming to a stop sign and then the FedEx truck is to the driver's left there. Okay, just humor me here in that scenario because that this happens a lot. We know this. Same situation here. Let's say it's not just an outright running of the stop sign for the driver, but it, you know, kind of goes forward, but still goes past the stop sign without stopping. Is that the same result here? It would not be foreseeable on the part of the FedEx driver that the driver would run the stop sign. No liability.
Yes.
Okay.
Simple answer to that question, Your Honor. And I'll explain, backtrack and explain why, is that I would hope at the end of the day the court upholds stopping at stop signs in this decision, because that's what this case is about. If there's a stop sign, there's a duty to stop there. One of the cases we cite for the defense dealt with, I think it's a Juvenat case, driver southbound had a stop sign, driver westbound had a stop sign. They could both see the stop signs clear. The driver southbound, who was the plaintiff, there was, I think it was a city, basically had some bushes or whatever obscuring further view down there. And so the driver westbound blew the stop sign. The accident occurred because the driver going southbound was relying upon to do it. And basically the driver's position, the plaintiff, was that, well, I could have acted defensively if I had a clear visibility of what was coming. And what the court said in that case is that the law will not tolerate the absurdity of permitting one to testify that he looked and did not see the danger. And just because there was a claim for defensive driving, it's the stop sign that matters. It matters in this case. What the court is dealing with, and you've got a bigger problem than perhaps just the fact of these cases, and I appreciate that, all these cases are pretty fact-specific. In fact, if you look at the Cahoon case in the 5th District Rule 23 decision, it gets to the end of the case. It's relied upon the plaintiffs on foreseeability and other issues, and it notes in the analysis, it basically states, we acknowledge a circuit court order indicating determined the condition of 63rd East was at most a condition, not a cause. And that was a rumping, a rubble on this roadway itself. However, we're unable to find anywhere in the order where it explicitly finds that a subsequent intervening act of a third person broke the causal chain and became the sole proximate cause. They didn't have a good record to make a decision on that case. In the case at hand, the court below made an excellent record, finding 7 or 8 undisputed facts, including the clear vision of what's required in there. And the other thing I'd like to point out that's not mentioned by the parties arguing for the plaintiffs in this case is that inherent with the stop statute, a statute, not an ordinance, is section 11904, chapter 625, ILCS, is that not only do you pull up and stop where you have an opportunity to view oncoming traffic, after having stopped, the driver shall yield the right-of-way to any vehicle entering the intersection which is posting so closely to the roadway as to constitute an immediate hazard. In the case law, several cases, you got to see what can be seen. Clear view should see it. The duty not only to stop, but to yield the right-of-way. And I believe, Your Honor, on those intersections where there's not a stop sign, that yielding the right-of-way is key. Whether it's coming from the right traffic required by law or the person closest to the intersection, that's going to govern it, I believe.
But well, this a question in that regard.
Sure.
is there a qualitative distinction? Do we get to foreseeability in that circumstance? Because I hear you saying that the stop sign is the absolute prohibition here in terms of a finding approximate cause, that you don't really need to get to the foreseeability here. It's a matter of a superseding or intervening event, somebody running a stop sign. When you have an uncontrolled intersection, that's a grayer area, isn't it?
I would agree, Your Honor, that is a grayer area. All these cases dealing with the legal cause and approximate cause are very fact-specific. And I believe the case before this court is very fact-specific. And I believe Judge Fellheimer took the time in a long hour or hour oral order to lay out the undisputed facts, the visibility, and the duty to stop, and then encompassed with that is a duty to yield. The facts of this case state that that was an intervening cause and that the corn itself was merely a condition. Did I answer your question, Your Honor? Okay. So it would be interesting to argue the other case maybe another time on or two, but I think it's very fact-specific. I cannot see how, with a legal cause, proximate cause analysis by the courts under the law that I have reviewed, that you can really come down with a one answer says it all, because they go way back to the other cases that deal with these, dealing with it going through. So I believe the cases we cite are on point. One quick point, because I think procedure management matters. The defendants in this case relied upon the Galliman case, and I bring that to the court's attention simply because it's a Supreme Court case, 1999. It comes from a Salmon County verdict that went up on appeal, and the appellate court affirmed a finding in favor of the jury for jury verdict against an illegally parked truck. But to his credit, Justin Steigman dissented. And the case even notes, in his dissent, Justice Steigman concluded that Dobson and ADM are entitled to judgment notwithstanding the verdict, because the illegally parked tanker truck was not the proximate cause of plaintiff's injuries. Instead, the truck constituted merely a condition that allowed Philipart's injuries to occur. Okay? And the Illinois Supreme Court adopted and agreed Justice Steigman's decision and then reversed the finding against the owner of the illegally parked truck. I think I'm at the end of my time, unless there are any other questions. I want to thank you for the opportunity to argue. It's nice that you appreciate the fact that you accepted an oral argument. I do like that. I do engage the conversation. So, in summation, on behalf of all defendants, and specifically Allen Haas Farms, Inc., and Allen Haas, or the Haas Farms, Inc., and Allen Haas, we ask the court to affirm the decision made by the circuit court in granting our motion for summary judgment. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Counsel.
Right, I have essentially 4 points I'd like to make. They don't have any particular order, so they're going to kind of jump around a little bit. The first rebuttal point I want to make is there's been a lot of discussion, understandably on some level, about cause and fact in this case. But the trial judge in this case did not consider or evaluate cause and fact. He did not evaluate our experts' opinions. He did not evaluate whether that was we've established a cause and fact case. What he talked about was purely legal cause. And as I heard just a couple minutes ago, I believe his decision was based on the assumption that any type of stop sign, any type of illegal behavior, basically is an intervening superseding cause, which is my second rebuttal point, which is that that's not the law. Calhoun, while it's an unpublished opinion, stands at least, and it's not alone in this proposition, stands for the proposition that sometimes illegal behavior can be foreseeable, and thus can be a subject to a legal proximate cause negligence case. Second point, or third point I'd like to talk about, is that there's a discussion about accident, that the plaintiff's burden is to prove that the accident itself would not have occurred. That's not the law. The law is whether or not the outcome would have been different, whether there would be less injury, less harm. It is not my burden to prove that the accident in total would not have occurred, just to show that the outcome would have been different and injuries, that is, the ultimate fourth element of a negligence case, that I've hit show damages in this case, which I can do, which plaintiff can do. And then the last point I'd like to make, and I know this has been talked quite a lot, particularly with Justice Harris's questions, but the ordinance makes no difference, does not make any distinction between its applicability to regulated, partially regulated, or unregulated intersections, which tells us that it cares about all three of those and that it's designed to increase visibility so that it can decrease the incidence of accidents. Your Honor, I appreciate the opportunity to argue before you, and of course, on behalf of both plaintiffs in this case, we would respectfully request that you reverse the trial court's decision on granting summary judgment.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, that concludes our arguments, and the court will stand in recess and issue a decision in due course.